Come on then, let's go. Right. Are you doing the intro?
I'm going to do it right now.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hang On To Your Hat, episode 34. And today in the studio, we have...
Warwick Field.
Bad Daddy, you're a naughty boy.
These days, fatherhood is everywhere. You can't get away from it. Not that blokes haven't tried. If you're not a father, you've got a father. You're a son of a dad or a daughter of a bloke. But either way, being a dad is no picnic. The fear, the anger, the confusion and, well, the love, of course. Oh. Derek Myers and Dan Lee, together with their special guests, are here to share the highs and lows, the joys and the agony of being a modern dad. But most of all, to let you know that you're not alone.
Hello and welcome to another episode. I don't know about this camera because it's
just
making,
ignore it.
Well, it's making me have a different voice. Hello, and that's
look
freaking
at
me out.
We'll forget the camera.
We've got Warwick here. Warwick Field.
Why does it make you have a different face just because there's a camera?
I don't know.
Just, or about a different voice.
Do you know what I think it is? The desire to hide my true self. It's a Peter Sellers type thing. Because I'm as clever as him. But I think it just makes me want
to. Because the visual aspect of it is something that makes it harder to hide than just a pure voice.
Exactly.
Because a pure voice, you can be saying anything, but pulling a funny face and nobody's ever going to know.
Exactly.
Which is really hard to do, probably, I'd imagine.
The promise of an edit with podcasting, you're completely free. There's no continuity issues.
And you read so much from what's going on in people's faces, not just what they say.
Yeah. Anyway, you forget that camera. Ladies and gentlemen of the audio world, we are, yes, I'm recording the video of this, hence Danny's unusual start.
Sorry about my confused beginning. Warwick Field, dog walker extraordinaire.
Yes.
Friend of mine, friend of Missy's.
Yes.
Cinematographer, father.
All those things.
All those things.
Not necessarily in any of those orders, of course.
No, that's right. So, yeah.
We've had a few fathers of adults defined by age, adults, in before. But commonly they're either Dan's dad or Missy's dad.
Right.
Yeah. So it's really good because you think, I've got a...
So I'm like 11. A first generation version of a...
You're right there.
Father of adult children.
Yeah.
Well, go on then. Well, let's get the statistics. What have you got?
Right. So I have two sons.
Yep.
Chris, who's 32 years old now.
Wow.
And I know. And you do the mathematics and you say, well, if he's 32. Yeah, I feel 20 years younger than I am.
That's older than my mental age.
Ah, yeah. And mine. And a second son, Dylan, who's 19 years old. And they are both wonderful kids from wonderful mothers, both of whom I'm no longer with.
Mm-hmm.
So one child per wife was basically my modus operandi.
Fair enough.
I thought that was probably... To be fair to my wives, all they could handle of me. And probably my sons would probably say the same thing as well.
Yeah. Best not to carry this on too far.
No.
Yeah. Keep it under control.
Good environmental thing. So time frame wise, you were married, had a kid, split up, so separate.
Yes.
Co-parenting. I don't know what you call it anymore.
Co-parenting, yes.
By the time number one, Chris was 13?
13 years old, yeah.
Good maths. You had another. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Did it earlier. Yeah. And then nearly forgot.
With his abacus.
Yeah. I went in too soon.
Yeah.
So then you met another partner and.
That's right, yeah.
In the normal everyday way and had another one.
Yeah, well, when I got married, I was warned not to be married as early as I did. I was about 22 when I got married the first time and I'd been dating this woman for quite a long time. We got on like a house on fire, but I was a long way short. You know, retrospectively now I know I was a long way short of actually understanding who I was. And in fairness to both of us, we probably should not have got married. She was also 6 years older than I was at the time. So it was probably 4 years into the marriage before Chris was born. And by that stage, it was already that classic mistake of, our relationship's not going great.
Right.
I'm sure a child would fix it.
Yeah. No, but you've got to keep stacking on, Warwick.
And all those listening out there, to all of you listening, was that a good idea? Nope. Yeah. And So it wasn't a good idea. I mean, obviously, you know, we love Chris and it's fantastic and thank goodness he came along, but it wasn't enough at that point to save the relationship. We'd just gone in very different directions.
Yeah.
I work as a cinematographer, so I work in the film industry, which is a terrible industry to be involved in and have a relationship. And especially at that time of my earlier years, I was travelling a lot, so I wasn't around. And, you know, there's just so many things going on in the world that by the time I was 25, I already felt like, how can I have already defined what the rest of my entire life is going to be when I really haven't had a, you know, much of a sample of everything there is to have in the world. So within a year of Chris being born, we were separated. So basically my entire life with Chris has been as an absent father.
Right.
As much as I tried to be there, he lived with his mum, which back then, you know, sort of in the 1990s was pretty well standard. The sharing arrangement, which I think has become more common now, where you do sort of 50-50, you might have a week on, a week off.
Yeah.
That was just not really a concept. It was still very much, you know, the child stays with the mother.
Yeah, I remember that, actually. I feel like that has changed, yeah.
Yeah, and his mum was terrific at raising him and looking after him and taking care of all of his needs. But it just meant that I would only see him, you know, for a week, you know, a weekend once a fortnight or so. So immediately I was down to, you know, 1/7 of the time I would have spent with him. And it's a real shame because I never really got to know him the way I would have if I'd been a father living at home. But, you know, these things happen and it would never have worked for us to have stayed together. It would have just been a terrible environment.
Yeah, could have been very damaging. So. Yeah. And with the film, with your career, even if it's not a career, if you're just working in film, surely you to do that 1 week on, 1 week off would be near on impossible, because all my friends in the, you know, early noughties, late 90s who were working in films around Melbourne, when Hollywood came, it was nuts. Like, they couldn't really commit to anything. Yeah. They didn't know, like, there was periods, long periods of time when they had to work all the time. And then they always had that fear of there being periods of time when they had nothing to do.
That's right. And that, I mean, you're absolutely right. And that added a lot to the complication of everything because not only was it an expectation that, you know, on that particular Friday night I'd pick up Chris and he'd stay with me the Sunday, but there was always on the Tuesday before that, the phone would ring and be like, okay, we're doing this shoot and we're going to go over the weekend. And so then I'd be ringing up my ex-wife and saying, guess what? You know, I'm not – and you know, that made me feel terrible because Chris was looking forward to seeing me. And so – but my whole life has been like that in terms of trying to manage life as a freelance filmmaker.
Yeah.
You never know when the work's going to come. It's often infrequent enough that you really can't say no when it does come. But, you just can't – it's very difficult to ever arrange anything, even a restaurant or booking. You know, I've got tickets booked for next year to theatre shows, and I've just decided now I'm just going to just randomly choose dates, because even if I try a week out to choose a date when I'm going to be available, there's a 50% chance that something will happen. If it happens, I'll just have to cancel. So raising the kids was a very similar thing. And school holidays, try and find 2 weeks in a row.
Oh, yeah.
So then suddenly the kid would be coming over and you'd have them around, but then on the Wednesday, Thursday, you had to go and shoot an ad, which is not from 9 till 5. It's you're on set at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
You're still not set at 7 p.m. The director's going, actually, maybe we should do another scene. And then you're thinking, child's at home, the babysitter's there, and now I'm going to be home at 10 o'clock. The guilt was just incredible, overwhelming. I think probably the key word for my whole experience of raising those two boys was just constantly feeling like I was just feeling guilty and inadequate in terms of being there for them.
Yeah.
That thing with the film industry too, because I've worked on a TV show for 6 months in the art department and stuff, and what was really obvious to me was that they want yes people. And I remember them saying that – I remember the director saying that there's no – don't say no to anything. It doesn't matter what it is. You say yes first and then you figure the rest out. And then there might be a – yeah, just there's no such thing as no. And like, if you're in the beginnings of your career too, in your 20s, there'd be even more pressure to be a yes man and go with, because it seems like a lot of people get hired from one job to the next. Like they get to know you.
There
if
is
you're
that,
a very
yeah.
If you're good at what you do and you're easy to work with, then they'll go to the you'll get the next one. A lot of people I know in film and TV go through a at least, especially an early period where they're just getting hammered and they've got to build up that kind of reputation of
hard. And you'll have a loyalty to a producer too. So right. if you're working on a TV series, for example, you might do, you know, Wentworth or Packed to the Rafters or something. And then when that finishes, the whole crew all go, now we're all going, but you know, 2 weeks out of the end of the shoot, everybody's talking about the next job and you're already you've mentally left the one you're on and you're all going to move as this big team of lighting guys and grips and camera team and everybody else, makeup and wardrobe, and just go along to the next one. And as you say, you can step off, but when you get off that train, you're at the platform and the train's gone.
Yeah.
And
so there's another in then.
There's a huge pressure and you know, if you want to stay in the game, you do have to always be available and you do have to always say yes.
Yeah.
And you actually can't even change that to a no most of the time and get away with it. So it is such a cliche. You know, like all the sitcoms you see about the film and TV industry are largely not exaggerated at all. I mean, they are as ludicrous, and the conditions and what you do and what you sacrifice to make some stupid show that nobody's going to watch.
Yeah.
Is just nuts. You know, you were sitting there at 11 o'clock at night on a Sunday when everybody else is doing something else and your kids are at home being babysat because you're working on some show that's going to change the world because the director suddenly wanted to reshoot, you know, scene 17.
I was just thinking about one particular story on that. We were this kids show in Broome when I was living up in Broome, and the director said to – there was two of us in the fucking art department. We were just so overworked, it was unbelievable. And he says to me, we need a worm.
Yeah.
So we're out on the desert, on Roebuck Plains, we need a worm. I'm like,
how deep do you have to dig to get a worm in the
desert? Well, you ain't getting a fucking worm, basically. And I said, but there's no worm. No, you're not understanding what I'm saying. I'm saying we need a worm. And I said, no, I know that. Yes. But what I'm saying to you is that they're not indigenous to the desert. And he's going, hang on a minute. So what we need is a worm. And so I had to go and get – so basically rather than saying –
go and get a tin of spaghetti.
And
put a fishing line on it.
So if you look at it like that, you go, well, so how do we fake it? So we went and found a variety of grubs and caterpillars, and they're like, well, can you paint it red? Like, it's just all that weird shit. So it's not exactly that – but it's mad. Like, that's – yeah, you've got to get used to that kind of...
Did you resort to the thing of saying, but I've just been through the script and it doesn't mention worm in the script?
Yeah, right.
So that's what art department yes. The first thing art department always goes, well, it's not in the script, which is fair enough because I had no warning.
Throw it straight back. It's your fault, mister.
You've read episode 13 and it says the kid's lying on the beach. Does it say he's playing with a worm? No. Therefore, I've provided no worm.
Exactly. And then what they used to do too is they go, this scene's transpiring, but it's just on the beach, right? And then they've somewhere along the line they've changed it to, it needs to happen in a dilapidated camp made from driftwood and parts of ocean wrecked boats.
So they're basically just riffing the show as they're going along.
And they and I go, you what? Where's that in the thing? And he goes, listen, we've got 10 minutes, so I'd have to make a set in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, some of that was fun and exciting until it wasn't.
Yeah.
When, you know, anyway, that, so I get that. That's just a
management style, though, just to go,
it's very
full
old
pressure.
School.
It's like understaffing nurses.
Yeah.
People are still getting their medicine, but the nurses are running ragged until they, you know, eventually, 20 years' time, there's less people want to be nurses, maybe.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, throw the pressure on. That's how they do it.
Everyone and I bet
just runs themselves ragged.
Yeah, and they just it's like sort of evolution. The people who can't cope just drop out.
That's
Do you now see? I'm sure you do. But like after I was on that show, for a while after that, every time I watched television, I could sort of see all the people who were just outside of the frame, because I know now that you have a serene shot of a beach, but the reality is there's about 35 people all kind of just out of shot.
Don't spoil it for me, Dan.
Oh, really?
So you can't watch it with the same suspension.
It's a classic analogy of the duck on the pond where you just see the duck going along and underneath it's chaos. And that does happen, of course. Yeah, like it'll be one person walking down a pristine beach with no footprints ahead of them and just out of shot. Seven lighting guys racing along with the reflectors and the boom up holding the microphone on a 60-foot boom pole, fighting the wind, just keeping it just out of the top of frame. And, of course, I mean, that's the magic. And that's look, this is all I've ever done in my career, is worked in film and TV, and I love it with a passion, and cinematography is something I'm just so devoted to and love it. And it doesn't matter. The novelty just – it just doesn't wear up because it's like being a magician.
Yeah.
And it's all about illusion, tricking people into thinking they're seeing things they're not or making things look like things that they're not. I mean, I don't know how many times we've been in a house and we've had to turn a bedroom into a nightclub for just one quick mid-shot of somebody, you know, dancing at a nightclub. They don't want to go to another whole nightclub. So you go, okay, well, what am I going to do to make this look like a nightclub? And then you think about what the elements of that are, and then you add all those things together. And then you watch and you go, holy shit, it really looks like we're in a nightclub. All we did was put a bit of sequin curtain in the background, a little spotlight, a bit of coloured backlight on her, and some flashing lights, and there you are.
Well, because, you know, it was a limited shot, right, too. Yeah. You're not panning around the whole.
That's how it's supposed to start, and then suddenly it goes into, actually, can we actually have the friend come into shots? Like, well, now I've got to go a bit wider, which means I'm seeing the bookcase, which really shouldn't. But, I mean,
what do you reckon is the most sort of extraordinary thing you've had to try and create? Like, what's your worm story? Or is that hard?
That's hard. Well, you know, with career spanning the length that one has, it's kind of hard to think of a particular solution like that. But it generally, probably the thing that constantly comes is dealing with weather issues that aren't really what they are. Like it's supposed to be 40 degrees and you're lying on a beach and you're actually in Brighton in Victoria in the middle of winter and it's 4 degrees and everybody's in bathrobes freezing to death and you pull them off at the last minute and trying to make, you know, hot scenes look cool and vice versa. Generally, they're the things that you deal with day to day, and also just within the course of a day, making a scene look coherent in terms of the continuity of the look as well. You know, cloud and sun and all that sort of thing. So you
did that to Missy once. Warwick and Tash Pinkus do a lot of her film clips. You've done quite a few, haven't you?
Yeah.
So everyone's waiting. She talks about
to Byron
being,
Bay.
Being put in the water in the middle of winter.
That's right,
fully clothed. Well, all day.
Come on, look. In fairness, we were originally going to shoot that down like in Torquay or somewhere.
Oh, shit.
And it was, I can't remember. I guess it was winter, July or August or something like that. And there's only so much wetsuit we could cut out wetsuit we could put down underneath her costume.
Yeah.
And Tash and I actually went down to Torquay just with a little GoPro camera to do some tests to see, what happens when the camera comes out of the water, just to get a basic idea of it.
Yeah.
And we're in there for 10 minutes. I said, there's no way we're going to be able to put Missy in this water even, you know, because by the time you get in, she has to do the performance and get out. And so we decided that a large proportion of the budget was going to go to actually travel expenses. We decided we had to go to Byron Bay where the water at least was.
Oh, was it in Byron?
Yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
What's she complaining about?
God. It was still
the fucking pop stars are always
holiday to Byron Bay.
It was, yeah.
Stand in a pond and sing.
It could have been worse. But I still remember we're all sort of, it was like 5 a.m. in the morning we got up because I wanted to get the sun.
It's a long time to be in the water.
Well, I wish she wasn't the whole time, but I wanted to get a shot with the sun coming up. And, I was going to say Queensland, but in northern New South Wales, the sun comes up pretty early. So it was like 5 in the morning or something. The sun was going to be coming over the horizon. So we're all up at 4 o'clock and Missy's getting the makeup on and whatever, and we're going to be walking out into the sea. And it's all well and good with me. I'm just holding a camera. I've got full, you know, wetsuit because I don't have to worry about anything. And she's got like a little shorty wetsuit underneath the jumper.
Yeah.
And we're walking out and I can just see her like shivering. And I'm saying, okay, so just in your mind, it's like really, really warm. It's really, really hot. And she turns around and she goes, just fucking shut up, Warwick. Because she was like psyching herself in and had to do the performance as well. Yeah. So anyway.
That wasn't the first one you did with her, was it? I think...
No, the first one we did was Unashamed Desire in the studio.
Ah, yeah, big studio shoot. With Chunky Move or something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Stephanie Lake was the choreographer.
Yeah.
And that was a real challenge for Missy especially because she had to – I think we had roughly about a week of dance rehearsal for her to learn quite a complicated choreography for that clip. And that was all shot in studio over a couple of days.
That was the second time I bumped into her before we got to – like I was – doing a reading of my play in the Beckett Theatre at Malthouse
the
time, and she just walked into the foyer of the of the Malthouse, and I went, oh, hey, because I'd met her the year before in Broome.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So I still remember that, and she was doing those dance rehearsals with...
That's right, in there.
Chunky Move.
That's right, yeah.
So there you go. Mm. So, yeah, but back to the kids. So that's made... Yeah, so that would have made it so much more difficult.
Yes.
To how did you do that, you're still in that business, so it would have been hard continually. So what did you do? Like
in terms of seeing the boys?
Yeah.
Oh, look, it was just a matter of just finding as much time as I possibly can to do it.
Yeah.
And I think they've both grown up being used to the fact that sometimes I'll be sitting around my ass for 3 weeks with absolutely no work, and we can go on road trips and do all sorts of things. And then there'll be other times when, I walk in the door at 10 o'clock at night and I'm gone at 5 in the morning, and that's, that's the quality time.
Mm.
So, it's funny how when you try and recollect what it was actually like, I mean, because obviously they're grown now, so I don't, need to hold their hand anymore.
Mm.
But there was a huge responsibility to be there as a parent, and to and to have the father role, and to influence them, and have that reciprocal arrangement you do have as two humans, between parents and children. And I was so shit scared of losing that opportunity, and because I was just dibbing in and out of their lives on a relatively infrequent occasion, it was very easy to feel like a visitor, and most of the time it was just quickly catching up on what's happened since last. Even though you might have spoken on the phone or might have spoken to their mums and found out what was happening at school or whatever, I always felt like I was behind.
Yeah.
And I'm using the word cliche a lot, but it's also that thing you hear all the time where, you'll see the kid and you don't realise that, 5 days last week they were off from school and they had a terrible cold. And you think, well, why didn't somebody ring me and tell me that? It's like, oh, what for? I was just home and I was sick. And then again, you think, wow, there I was just going along in my life and my child had a terrible cold and I was unaware of it.
Yeah.
And it's probably easy to sort of say, oh, well, that was my fault. Why wasn't I in contact with them every day to find these sort of things out? But you have to remember, too, that when you come from a broken marriage is that that relationship has ended because things weren't great.
Right.
So you've also got to deal with the fact that you're being forced to stay in contact with somebody who otherwise you wouldn't be in contact with just because things hadn't worked out.
Yeah.
So you've also got to deal with that with, your ex-wife's obviously, disappointment in the fact that a relationship hadn't worked out and that you're not there and that they're doing 99% of the parenting and you just pop in like the celebrity every now and then. So you got to first spend a bit of time cutting through all that stuff. Then you get to finally finding out with your kids. And then, of course, you say, so what's happened in the last couple of weeks? And it's like, nothing really. It's like, well, something must have happened. And then and then you'll have cues because the mum had told me that, by the way, they won the best and fairest in the footy or something like that. So it's hard to gain
that kind of that ground, that basis that you take for granted when you're with kids all the time.
Well, the thing that I missed the most and I still regret so much was just that everyday thing of breakfasts every day of the week or packing the school lunch and sometimes because I was a freelancer I was able to have the boys over and as I got older sometimes I had both at the same time when they were both still in Dylan would be in primary school and Chris would be in high school. And they could come and stay during the school term because I wasn't working. And so I did have a few instances of that day-to-day thing of, making the lunch and sending them off to school and then being home when they got home from school and,
Did that trigger anything when you did that? Did you go, God, I'd love to do this every day? Or did you think, glad I don't have to do this every day?
Should I give you the answer that I should say or should I give you the really
honest answer? Yeah, both.
The honest answer is I'm probably a bit too selfish to actually be one of those classic parents who just absolutely loves parenting and doing all the day-to-day things because I've got so many things I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think most people out there would be honest enough to say themselves that they always feel like they need more me time. I've had plenty of me time, more than anybody really deserves. But I do genuinely regret the fact that I didn't have a lot of time with those day-to-day things with them. And it does, it creates a lot of sadness. I really feel like I missed out. There's so much about them that I will never know. It doesn't matter what happens from here on to the end. But through that whole growing period of when they're, when they're little kids and when they're going, and the teenage years and all those things. Of course, I experienced those things, but you don't get all the nitty gritty of the how many times I wake up during the night when they got the cold and things. That would only happen to me, you know, once a fortnight.
We talked to someone about that, about the idea of quality time and stuff too, that you can't just engage quality time when you want to. It comes packaged with all this minutiae and daily stuff that's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
And
well, you need the lead up to it. You can't just walk in and say, hi, take a seat, let's have some quality time.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to just ease into it. And when you only have, you know, maybe 2 days a fortnight, which I did a lot of the time, they're just settling in by the time you're packing them up and taking them back home again.
Mm. You need all the sitting around doing nothing time just as much as the quality time in order to get a really strong understanding of who they are. So did you have have you had periods as a result of this where you've had to kind of come up against issues with them, like especially with having boys, if you weren't there as much as you would have liked to, did they have teenage years where they had a bit of a reckoning with you and
there's never really been a confrontation. I guess this is probably something great to say about both the boys is that there was never a point where they came up and said, you know, how dare you say it to me? You're not even around.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it didn't need to be said because we all knew it. You know, it was the elephant in the room. And so, the answer is no. Mm. No, I mean, obviously through the teenage years, they're teenage boys.
Yeah.
I went through all that things of suddenly I knew nothing apparently.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing, your kid turns 13 years old and immediately you're rendered completely stupid.
Don't tell Derek that.
Know nothing about anything. Oh,
sorry, my kids are both rehearsing regularly.
They're rehearsing for pulling the carpet under him.
It's like, you know, where is this in our DNA or in our nurturing or whatever it is that's creating this, that a child gets to that age where they just suddenly, and I know there's a million people out there probably have the answer to this question, but where does suddenly that cute little 9-year-old kid who just wanted to sit on your lap,
who's awestruck by everything you tell them.
Yeah, yeah. And believe everything you say up to a point.
Maybe that's why they turn when they're 30 and they find out you've been bullshitting
the whole time. That's right, yeah. Dad, you never toured with Elton John? Oh, yeah, no, I was just, I didn't really.
I toured with Elton John's old touring manager.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is, and just suddenly you get to that point where during those teenage years it is very difficult to communicate with them, and they are just grumpy and they just do stay in their room, and it's kind of like somebody recovering from some horrible disease and just in a bad mood for a few years. And Dylan, my 19-year-old, sort of, he was like that probably till about 17, and then all of a sudden one day he just rolls up and he was smiling again and everything. I've got 4 years of photograph of him just scowling every time somebody pointed a camera at him. And it wasn't that he was unhappy. It was just those classic teenage years. And I guess some people don't sort of suffer that sort of puberty as badly.
Yeah.
I've certainly got some friends whose kids just seem to cruise through those years and from my perspective, from the outside, maybe I didn't see the true story, seem to be pretty pleasant the whole time.
Oh, they're the ones that end up in the clock towers with the automatic weapon.
Yeah, that's right. Have puberty at age 24.
Yeah, they're planning something terrible. When you say, you know, regrets and guilt, or I've been putting a bit of thought lately into the general time frame of parenting, I guess, just going, all right, we assume it's the rest of our lives.
Born.
We're late bloomers, yes. Me and Dan both. And so you go, right, okay, the kid's born, that's that then. And you go, and you tell yourself, doesn't matter, because I was wild as, and I did everything I ever wanted to do, and it's finished now. But then I'm 11 years in, which is just like that.
Mm.
I'm going, fuck me, it's only really 7 years till Boy Wonder is 18.
That's right.
So I'm only 7 or 8 years behind you, and I'm listening to you like you've, you know, it's the old time kind of experience that's done now.
But, I guess you've had plenty of guests on who've spoken about this in the past, but there's nothing that can really prepare you for parenthood with that first child when you have all these ideas about – oh, the child will be born, and I know for the first few months we'll have some sleepless nights, but, you know, we've got a great relationship. We'll get through it. But I tell you what, those nights can be dark and lonely. And again, I know I haven't been there. When both the boys were young, I was there the whole time. But, you know, after so I've experienced the first couple of years as a full-time parent. Yep. So this I can speak with authority. Well,
that's something. That's, this you've I earned can your stripes with that.
Yeah. So I went through the sleepless years. Mm. But you can't really be prepared because you do have this sort of concept of things you've read about or seen on TV, the way it's always depicted, and and listening to podcasts and so forth, I guess, as well, where you have this idea about I know it's going to be rough, but I'll pull the Band-Aid off and then it'll be done, and then they'll be through. And then before you know it, they're in kindergarten, I'll be able to go back to playing golf and stuff. No, because it's constantly – you need to adapt as a – I mean, you're a person of – you're a person with your own struggles to begin with, yeah. You know, understanding yourself and your work life and your relationship life and all that sort of thing that you got to deal with as a human being anyway. But then you transpose that over raising a child for which you didn't actually do a course on. You didn't go to uni and do, you know, 101 in child raising. You're just somehow supposed to know this innately. So you're trying to raise a child, deal with a difficulty that might be going on in a relationship because you're both at your wit's end. And also then your own thing. And then as soon as the child is one thing, a little baby, then they morph into a toddler. Yeah. And then they morph into a young primary school. And then they morph into puberty. And all of these ages, all these stages of their development require completely different approaches and parenting skills. You know, how much should you interact with them? Should I smother them or should I give them their space? I don't want them to feel abandoned. You know, like if I give them some space, I don't want them to suddenly think they don't love me anymore and why aren't I getting any assistance? And in their life day to day, that's changing. One week they might want to sit on your knee and the next week they don't want to be in the same room as you. It's tough.
So you're all trying to cope. Don't know what the fuck's going on. Like they go to they go to the toilet and walk out a teenager.
Yeah.
But Luna just like
that's a lot of toilet paper. Yeah.
It's sort of like that. They go to bed one child and wake up another one.
Well, I came around to your place last week, I think it was, and saw Luna. I hadn't seen her for probably 6 months. I couldn't. My jaw dropped open at how much she'd grown. I mean, obviously at such a young age, they change that quickly. But I hadn't seen her for several months and I just was like, wow, this is not like a tiny little baby anymore. Now this is a little kid.
And turned into a person.
Yeah.
As soon as she was on her feet and had just the start of some agency and some control of her life, she just – everything takes off. Then her attitude kicks in, like I want this and I don't want that and – fucking, what are you standing around for? Pass me that. Give me something to eat. There's a lot of pointing and waving her hands.
Gender differences.
And they say they say that cats have staff. I can tell you, kids have staff too.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
I hope you're on a good hourly rate, are you?
Yeah. Yeah, no, there does seem to be the traditional differences between boys and girls that people are saying. I mean, she seems to have developed certain stuff sooner than he did.
Yeah.
I think girls – sort of physical wiring is they're more dexterous earlier.
What they gain in being smarter, they also gain in being manipulative and evil. Sorry, everyone. Yeah. This is just a bloke's only listenership.
No, she's ferocious. Like,
is that? Do you think that's a generalisation, or would you say from the people you've spoken to in your own experiences that there are definite differences between the boys and girls when they're very little?
Well, but apparently there's neurological, like the rate of development's different too.
Yeah, well, that we know. Yeah.
So the brain thing, what's being wired and when is different. But the peculiar thing for me about Luna is her making choices about things, where Sammy doesn't like choices. He'd much rather you just, in fact, it's better not to tell him what it is. So she started getting hats and clothing when she turned one. She'd be pointing at things in the cupboard.
That's what I want to wear.
Putting different hats on and different jackets. Now, we're not, Sammy, you could put him in a paper bag. He wouldn't give a shit. In fact, he wears his...
Well, that explains what he was wearing today.
What was he wearing
today?
No,
I was just kidding.
But he goes to kinder
with... A recyclable bag, I would hope.
He goes to kinder with his pants on backwards and his jumper inside out, and he does that regularly. And the pants on backwards is really uncomfortable, but he insists on it. So he's got the pockets.
Oh, hang on, that's a style decision.
So he's decided to do that.
But it's not about. It's just trying to be weird.
No, but you see,
it's not a fashion.
It's a style decision.
But if you put your pants on backwards, mate, when you put your pants on backwards, that means as you're walking in, you're facing out,
right?
So psychologically, he already wants to be leaving.
Yeah.
Or keeping an eye on the door like a gangster.
Needs his pants balloon out at the front because that's where his ass is meant to be. And then he's got this big bow at the back of it. Like, it's very strange. But Luna's like, she goes and gets her rain jacket, hands it to you, and her shoes, and then you put them on, and then she goes to the front door and jangles the handle to leave. Now, as soon as she was up and walking, like one, we're talking, and she's
that's not obviously not a general case like you were asking me for, but it is really, really common to hear this. Because you can get two different types of kid.
Yeah.
Totally. Even though the girls might generally be smarter. We all got brought up getting told girls are 2 years smarter than boys.
Yes.
That was just the fact, wasn't it?
2 years. Yeah. 2 years and probably a millennia in some cases as well.
Well,
yeah,
but it's a wiring thing. Like that, when I saw Bidulph, he was saying the reason boys can't sit still when they're five at school is because the wiring of their brain to their physicality and their movement is still happening, where it's already been achieved with girls.
Yeah.
They're much more physically dexterous earlier. Like, she can feed herself now, and Sammy's, I mean, she's arguably better at feeding herself than he is, and he's 4.5.
Yeah.
So, but that's just, I was led to believe that that's just a neurological and a developmental thing, that's a boy-girl thing.
When my son is overpowering my daughter.
But perhaps it's also to do with independence. I mean, maybe she wants to be able to be independent. Maybe that's something that she values higher than Sammy does.
Well, being second born too, you want to catch up. You want to be in control. So
you've always got that example of everything, every stage. They're watching every stage.
Oh yeah,
it makes a big difference as well. It's not just a gender thing.
Mm.
The other fascinating thing is she just loves him no matter what happens. So he can hit her and knock her around. And the other day I came home and I'd been away for the day, and she came down the hall towards me and I went, "Hey!" And she just walked straight past me and kind of shrugged me off. And then Sammy gets home and she gives him a big hug and won't let him go. And, you know, he knocks her over. Yeah. "Get out of the way!"
I said to my boy a few times, I said to him, "Listen, if I were you, I would watch your back because you are overpowering Clover in the most, you know, simplest bullying kind of way. And it's a big, big mistake because within a couple of years, she's going to be smarter than you." She could potentially be stronger than you as well. But she will work out a way to hurt you way more than you can hurt her now. I'd make friends with her if I were you.
One of the first things she did when she could walk was get up, walk across the room and smack Sammy in the mouth.
Yeah.
Because finally I can walk
exactly. and I owe you this.
Yeah, whereas he could give her a kick and walk away because she was crawling. Yeah. Far out.
But I think it's definitely there's two teams. There's the parental team and then there's the siblings team, the kids.
Seems like it now.
And I guess that's the thing is that probably even at a very young age, the kids are aware that, like, you know, we're team children. And we need to make sure that we gang together and protect ourselves against team parent. Of course, always want to make us do things we don't want to do, like eat the food we don't want to eat, or go to school when we don't want to go to school, or go on that drive when I don't want to have to go to the shops.
So you're all the same regime, aren't they?
Yeah. So it's like strength and unity.
There's been a couple of times now where they'll be sort of, because they're now playing together. It used to be just Sammy not wanting to be, like, he was jealous of her and she was a nuisance. He's now realised that she's a disciple. So you'll be able to hear them in the other room and then it'll go silent. And I go, "You go in there," and he's fucking indoctrinating her.
Yeah.
He's in the corner and she's sitting there wide-eyed and he's muttering things to her. Mm. And I'm like, "What are you doing? What are you talking about? Are you trying to topple this empire from, you know, like..."
Definitely.
"Mummy and Daddy think that we can..."
That's right, yeah, that's right.
They're plotting.
"They don't know that I know where the chocolates are hidden."
This is an illegal gathering.
Yeah.
Yeah, Clover's always getting sent on those missions.
Oh, yeah.
Go and ask. You can sense it. She goes, "Dad, is it all right if we..." And you go, "Bring him in. Tom, come here."
So, Derek, how old are your children?
9 and 11.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So, I wanted to talk to you about... Sorry to cut it off.
No, you're right.
But I'm really interested in this time frame thing, because going way back, like focusing on those not being there all the time during a certain age. But then I'm realizing, like I was saying before, that this shit's going forever, you know? And I'm thinking the difference between, like if your guys haven't even brought up, when they were teens, why can you say that? You're not even here kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're in a good position. Like as in they haven't got that thing, well, dad just wasn't interested in having kids and fucked off.
Neither of them.
They understand what position you were in.
Yeah. But neither of the boys are sort of antagonistic by their nature anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they will get angry about things, but they won't. I guess the point is, and I'm not sure whether it's as academic as this, but it's like there's not really much point raising something that's not going to make a difference. I mean, I guess we all bring things up with people. We want to, like, you know, chew the bone about something or bring up something that's frustrated you, annoyed you, but often to no end.
Yeah.
I mean, so what? You're going to talk it out. Unless it actually affects some sort of change, what's the point? And I think with the boys in both cases, I guess it was sort of like, well, this is just the way it is. But
were you particularly clear about that though? Maybe you, one way or another, made it very clear to them that this was not about them being less important, that the nature of what you do.
Maybe.
Because that would well, make
I hope
a difference.
So. I hope so.
So did you talk to them a bit about it? Did you kind of say, I mean... Well, they understood, obviously, that you had a job that was pretty.
That's right, and they would come to set, and there's always that kind of thing about being on a film set. It's kind of like it's not a normal job. It's like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of bullshit baffles brains thing going on there anyway. Yeah. They're already kind of a bit enamored with the whole thing of well, you know, dad's doing this thing. It's like, and he's not just doing something really unimportant like saving lives. He's actually out making like a TV show that nobody's ever watching.
Yeah.
And they were already conditioned. Right from the beginning, that was the industry that I worked with, and Dylan's mum also worked in the film industry, which she doesn't now, but she did as well. So even though he never experienced her working in the industry because she had retired from it when he was born, it was still something very much in the household that was always spoken about as this is this way of life.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's kind of a bit like being on the road with a band or something. It's kind of like it's just a lifestyle choice as well as everything else. I don't know that I can't recall ever sort of sitting down and having an earnest discussion or ever sort of saying, it didn't need to be said that these children, that I love these children, they're important to me. I mean, that was just known. And I doubt that at any point, no matter any arguments we might have had about anything, at any point did they ever feel that they weren't loved. Mm. They might have disagreed with me or they might have been pissed off with what was going on.
But one way or another, they got that from you. It's not
maybe.
You don't have to tell. Well, it's not just because sometimes people can say things all the time and it doesn't mean anything.
Mm.
But if you're genuinely, interested in, they pick it up in other ways.
Look, I think humans are probably not as sensitive as a lot of other animals in terms of being able to sense things just within a room. But there's no doubt that even at a very young age, I mean, it's part of our survival instinct. At a very young age, you work out what's dangerous and what's safe and where your food comes from and where the shelter is.
Mm.
And I guess that a lot of, especially when you're related by DNA, your children, they're going to sense things anyway, I guess, without without needing necessarily put it into words.
So they know that. So when they get into the teen years, I'm just trying to pinpoint.
Then they forget everything.
Yeah. the regrets, I'm trying to pinpoint to a tiny little it feels like a tiny little time frame.
Mm.
One good thing would be the timing of the breakups, because they didn't experience dad leaving. They would have been two or three.
Well, in Chris's case, Chris was only about a year old when we split up, and that was in a way much more difficult for me because he was still a baby in nappies, and I felt terrible about.
But for him.
But for him, he would never have known me as somebody living in the house.
Yeah.
Whereas Dylan was seven when
seven,
I left.
Seven, okay.
Yeah. So that was quite different because he was already going to school and our relationship, his mother and my relationship had been sort of going downhill for quite a while. It was we were both to blame. I mean, I'm sure she'd agree with me if she heard that. No, she wouldn't. I'll take a bit out. He'd already experienced sort of arguing in the house. I mean, not yelling and screaming and throwing things, but just unhappiness.
Yeah.
And my nature is very much that I hate conflict. You know, I will like saw my own leg off than have an argument with somebody.
There's not
about
many
something.
Blokes who do like conflict, to be honest.
No, but it's not a fear of it. It's just the point that often the conflict comes from something that's irreconcilable anyway.
Yeah.
Or even if it's not, it feels like it is, so therefore it may as well be. If you're not prepared to do something to change something, then it may as well be unsolvable. Yeah. So there was a degree of sort of unhappiness and bitterness, and at the time with Dylan when he was a young boy, the film industry had was in a real downturn, so I was really struggling for work. So there was a huge amount of pressure, and at the same time, Dylan's mum had stopped working because she was raising a child, and she went at that point. She decided to go to university and study psychology, which is something she'd always wanted to do.
Mm.
So she was a full-time student. So when I wasn't working, I was the full-time dad. So I basically spent a lot of time at home with Dylan doing the going to school and that whole thing for the first 7 years. But then I had to go and find alternative work, which was something I really didn't want to do.
Like a proper job?
A proper job, yeah, which actually involved like, you know, hard work and getting dirty and cut hands and things, doing gardening work for a while. So I was incredibly resentful because I sort of felt like nobody understood how difficult it was that the film industry had collapsed and the thing that I was passionate about wasn't servicing my needs anymore, and I was addicted to this thing. I needed my filming hit.
Yeah.
So I was miserable about that. You know, I was at a point in my career where, like, if this goes on too much longer, I'm going to be too old, it's all going to be over, I will have missed the boat entirely. And I'm needing to go out and work just to pay for the groceries and so forth, while mum is not working and studying something that, you know, was of course important and ended up leading to a career for her. But at the time it was like, why aren't you contributing? So that was all me. That was just me being really bitter and angry about the world at that stage. Mm. And I wasn't great to be around. And so all those things mattered to the point where it felt like nothing was ever going to change. And retrospectively, I think if we'd got through that part of our relationship and my work had picked up and she'd finished the uni degree and she'd gone out, I still think our marriage would have failed because there was still too many points of difference about things.
Mm.
And also because I, although I've been very much the same sort of person most of my life, I've also had quite big swings about my sort of feelings about certain things. So if that hasn't been synchronous with my partner, poor them. You know, like, you know, suddenly like blue is the greatest color. Red is now the greatest color. It's like, well, hang on. I thought we liked blue. Like, no, we like red. And so I've sort of changed my aspect about things, like worldly things, in quite a long way, and made some big shifts. I mean, some of the things that I used to condone and think were okay, now I would be so critical of my younger self for having those beliefs. Right. And so if
that's fairly common, I think
it is common. Well, I think I was quite immature for a long time. Yeah. And it took me a long time to actually lift my head up from my own selfish world and look at what was happening out there in the world and go, you know, climate change and all these things and all the things that are related to that and how as humans on Earth we need to be better and how we need to be better animals among all the other animals. And I was starting to get so, and still am, so frustrated and get so intolerant of so many of the things that people do that it forced me to actually face up to myself and become a person that I really always knew I should be in terms of my own values and ethics.
Mm.
And I run into people now who hadn't seen me for years and go, oh, wow, now you're one of those hippie wanker, vegetarian, animal-loving people. It's like, I think I was, but it just wasn't convenient for me to do it at the time, you know. Or I was, you know, I really like that steak.
Yeah.
I like that steak far too much to really actually care about the cow. Now I go, you know what, I'd rather see a happy cow than eat the steak.
Yeah.
And I think that only came with being on Earth long enough to realize it and just seeing enough misery and everything else and suffering that go on to the point where you just can't ignore it anymore. So I changed a lot, and that's not an easy thing for somebody that marries you as a type A person, and then now they're married to a type B person. And
well, this is where marriage to change. You've got to be married. You know, you've got to be married and accept what they're going to be, especially in your 20s.
Yeah, that's
your,
right.
Your 20s.
Oh, look, I'm a terrible partner.
The first one.
Really, I'm a shocker.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
They're ready to be taunted, though. They'll go, oh, you know, like they can taunt you, but they have to accept a change unless it's.
Well, and it depends what the relationship's founded on. What it's founded on too. Like I feel like Missy and I have got a great advantage that I haven't had as much of in the past, is that we both met at a time when we were going through big change in our kind of approach to the world. And so we met and bonded over sharing that. Like I was talking about why I was in Broome and what I needed to change, like getting sober, going on that journey. She was trying to see her work and creative life differently and change her priorities. And because we met on that, it means that there's more flexibility with other stuff. Because like you said, Derek, about you, if you're expecting change, then change is not going to be so hard. So far, so good.
And I guess you'd both also lived enough of your lives at that point to sort of had the idealistic idea of what the way things were going to be and experimented with that and thought, okay, well, now I need to get real or now I can identify what I feel is missing in my life too.
Yeah. Well, like you said, and you can't – the problem with it took you to get to a certain age to get to certain understandings, and everyone's on a different journey with stuff and you can't force it. You can't make your younger self be –
No.
You sort of have to take the journey. You have to get there your own way. Because as soon as people do something because they feel like they should, rather than because they've arrived at it through their own experience, it doesn't last.
It doesn't.
Or it's hollow or it's...
But let's be honest.
But it's hard.
There are a lot of things that we do need to do as social animals to get along with the other animals that does require us to do things we don't necessarily want to do because it's the right thing to do.
I know, but how do you... But I just mean, say for climate change, for example, which we're passionate about and something obviously has to be done. But the contradiction we have is that people... Anything really important like that, you have to find your own way to it. We don't have the time to do that. We can't allow people to. So we're having to kind of force people to make changes that then they push back against. Mm. So this is where I think a lot of this pushing against our own self-interest comes from, is just because people don't like being told, even if it's a survival thing. It's like people will vote for Trump knowing that he's going to destroy their certain aspects of their life just because they don't like the people who are telling them that they should behave a certain way.
You're not the boss of me.
You're not the boss of me, so I'll vote for a guy who's going to destroy me and you. Like, it's crazy, but we need to take that into account in terms of how humans operate. And that's the biggest challenge with climate change I see, is that everyone needs to come to it themselves, but we don't have the luxury of that. That's anymore. Right. They're not all going to do it the way
I'm
fucking hard.
Severely inadequate and authorised to make political comments because I just don't have that education. But one of the things that constantly frustrates me is every time there's a discussion about anything related to major changes as humans on Earth we need to do to preserve what we can possibly still salvage, the first thing the politicians talk about is the economic result of it. And it's like, we need to go ahead with the Adani mine because 11 people will get jobs for 2 years. It's but then we're all going to be dead anyway. It seems such – I can only assume that I'm naive and there's so much stuff I don't understand that people who are much smarter than me do understand. But it just seems to be so ridiculously short-sighted. And none of us – we're sort of – living in a wonderful world. You know, we're lucky to live in Australia and have all the things we've got and have all the choices and live, like, by comparison to a lot of people in the world, absolutely fantastic, fortunate lives. But we're not prepared to really concede any of those things, that, even though we know we should. Like, you know, okay, I'm prepared to completely give up whatever it is because I know that my tiny little 0.00001% of the thing might make a tiny little difference to one part of Victoria. I think it's just human nature to go, what difference does it really make if I do this? Because everybody else is still going to keep on using plastic bags anyway. And so what if one tortoise dies, who cares? There's heaps of tortoises, aren't there?
But this is the fact where democracy fails in some ways too, is that when you've got a four-year election thing or three, like if politicians can't think in the long term, because if they're not in at the next election – then they can't do anything. No. This is a big flaw with our democratic system.
Isn't that so obvious?
The alternative is to have a dictatorship, a benevolent dictatorship. The problem with that is you can't make a it's luck that you get. But as long as they're trying to get in,
it's next not luck because only a fucked. Super asshole will manage to climb to the top of the the rush to become the dictator.
But I can see
the
why
good guys don't win. Like I said yesterday, you don't send a spiced and flavored naked Christian in to fight lions in the Colosseum. You've got to have a prick that has your beliefs, but is also a prick, i.e. politician.
But I can see why.
When you go to sell a house, suddenly you want – real estate agents to be arsehole. The absolute lying pricks that they are.
Yeah,
so human nature comes in and overrides
– that's a perfect analogy.
The beliefs you want to have.
Yeah, I mean, having bought and sold a couple of houses, that's exactly the perfect – it's like the real estate that you want to – the real estate agent that you want to sell your house is not the real estate agent you want to deal with when you want to buy a house.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, I mean
– but you can see why – because
they lie on behalf of you and you just pretend that's not happening.
When she's
– hang on. Real estate agents lie?
Well, I'm just guessing.
When the Chinese president Xi Jinping or whatever his name is that his name? Is he a president or a prime minister? He's a president. Anyway, the Chinese leader decided he wanted to have no limit to their terms so that he could be the leader for the term of his natural life.
Mm.
At first, we in democracies like ours go, that's outrageous, that's a dictatorship. But then on the other hand, you go, well, but the only way he's going to get anything done – I mean, look at how we are stuck in Australia by these limits that
with our 18-month term for prime ministers.
It is suicide. Yeah, it's suicidal.
Have a look at England.
It doesn't go with climate change. Climate change and short-term electoral cycles don't work. Hopefully, at least with the Chinese leadership, he's fairly environmentally interested, at least in pollution and stuff like that, and climate change because they're. It's their century coming. But that's the – I can see why he wants to have that.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck, I don't know. I don't know what
– Where does your 19-year-old stand and all – does he talk about this sort of stuff? Like, are they freaking out going, you pricks, you killed my world?
What
do
we talk to the kids about with this stuff? Yeah.
It's obviously an issue of real concern for the kids. I mean, Dylan, my 19-year-old, we don't sort of – we don't avoid the conversation, but it's not the first thing we talk about. But anytime these sort of things do come up in conversation, there's obviously a lot of anger that you know, the 50, 60, 70-year-olds that have presumably not totally responsibly got into this situation but certainly not been doing enough to help have now positioned the world in such a way that the future is looking bleak. And it's like – but like – I've stood in this queue now. I've popped out, and it's my turn on Earth, and you guys have fucked it up. You know, I've arrived, and you've eaten all the ice cream, and all that's left is one broken cone in the shop, right? And that's what you're leaving me. So there's a lot of anger, and it is going to take the youth, I think, you know, to actually do anything, because the youth talking to the you know the 60-year-old, 70-year-old politicians are not making anything because they're not going to listen to it. But when they become their own government and they end up being in power and they're moving as a unity together, if it's not too late, that's about the only time anything's going to change.
I see a time in about 20, 30, 40 years. I had an idea for a play, and it's just the title, The Nuremberg Climate Trials, where those – the Greta Thunbergs or whatever you pronounce of – are actually putting people on trial and executing them for what they've done. And I don't feel like that's a crazy thing to say. And I look at these people, commentators and older people, who look at her outraged and angry statement at the UN and say, oh, she's the poor girl. So they've upset her. Like, people have got to start helping. She's mentally ill and she's scaring all the children. And you're like, fuck, you've got to start listening to this girl.
Yeah.
Because – and the kid, she's not scaring them. The kids are scared. That's why – so you've got 50-year-old television commentators receiving it entirely the wrong way. Like, dude, she's not making them scared. But they are scared.
It's a shame that the media is just focused in on one particular event.
Where, that's how they roll.
Yeah.
Because they're assholes.
Because, well, it's a great soundbite and everything else. But, but you know, whether or not she speaks for her generation, which probably undoubtedly she does and most would agree with what she says, the point of the matter is that even though it's only one person saying this, this is the general popular voice anyway. So when you have the naysayers saying, oh, she's just a you know silly little girl, doesn't know what she's talking about, she'll go back to school, they're not really talking to her. They're not talking to Greta. They're talking to that entire generation of
damaging their relationship.
Apart from anything that's dangerous.
Who all feel the same.
Yeah.
Apart from anything that's dangerous, because they're going to fucking come for us.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, they're going to come for us. Maybe not you and I, but for our generation, they're going to come for us.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be
And we're all going to be on that last little bit of Everest, the only bit of land still above the sea.
Yeah.
All 97 billion of the humans are fighting one another over whose fault it was.
No, it's they've got to start listening to them. I don't know what. Yeah, man, I don't know.
It's just how it is. You protect your own thing. Maybe it's like parenting, when you finally get into politics. Like the people that protested Vietnam War and then got into politics, and then they have to start backing down. When I think about everything that, Peter Garrett did was awesome, legend. And then he gets into the real system, into the Labor Party, and just had to face this. I really felt for him there. Had to face the realities of the sickening realities of politics and how it works. It's not doing good. There's no time. There's hardly any time for doing good things.
And he came in with
Rudd. Fighting people doing bad.
But there's some luck there too. He happened to come in under Rudd, and Rudd was Rudd and was making it difficult too.
He's what scapegoat. This whole insulation thing finished him off.
Yeah. Garrett.
Yeah.
And he, you know.
Didn't finish him off. Finished him off in.
But how devastating is that? Look, the whole thing's unbelievably complicated, and I think it's very foolish to think anyone's simply just crazy or a dickhead or not trying. I think they all believe they're doing the, even Trump, they're trying to do something and they believe what they're doing.
The playing field is just ridiculous and it's unusable. The playing field for politics
that's
is
what
now
we're seeing.
Unusable.
It can't be, and it's things like climate change that are bipartisan and big enough that we can't do that short-sighted thing. But I don't know what the alternative is. Like I said, what is it? It's dictatorship, you know, benevolent dictatorship. How do you make that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting to see where all this is going to go.
Well, let's leave those thoughts for our audience to send us messages on the social media and let us know how they feel. I want to know about intergenerational bickering and fighting and blaming, because I don't remember it when I was a kid. I remember grown-ups were all shit, but then you were one and that was it. But now it seems that millennials are fighting back now. I've noticed they're fighting back going, hey, stop picking on millennials. You stuffed the world. Piss off. You sat by while your dad stuffed the world, and it goes on and on, all this blaming and
finger. But that's because they're seeing
at least there's a conversation.
The effects of it. We were scared of nuclear attack. But none of that ever materialised. Whereas for them, climate change is starting to show up. They're starting to see it.
Well, the fearful thing, the scary thing about this situation is that it's nothing that can now be controlled by humans. I mean, the nuclear thing was a button, you know, if anybody was going to press a button or not was a different matter. But
and if it didn't happen,
we can't get to the end of this conversation and go, actually, look, let's just stop climate change. That was a bad idea. Let's just turn it off.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not up to us anymore. This is a natural thing that is just gaining momentum, and depending on who you talk to, possibly too late to turn back.
Yeah.
Well, technology actually might be the only thing now that can, because you have to extract carbon as much as so. But
We've created a world, you know, based on largely on democracies where every little parcel of land has been claimed by somebody. They've stuck their flag and said, okay, this is my bit, that's your bit. And they're all trying to make their own economy work and their own social structure work and everything. Whereas the globe is the globe, and we're all human beings on a planet.
Yeah.
And as long as we're all trying to fight our own little fights and try and make our own little puzzles work, I think probably it'll just turn into some Armageddon where like eventually all the politics and everything will break down. Economy will be completely pointless because all it'll be is a struggle for food, shelter and water.
Well, that's the popular.
And then we'll just all have to just come together on our little rafts and then fight against that.
We'll come together.
This whole thing will come unravelled for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah.
We'll be right.
So what you didn't explain before I came in here, this is actually just therapy for you two guys.
Yeah, yeah, you worked it out. And
I'm just
working
it out. I'm just kind of like the moderator.
You're going to be charged $200 an hour for this therapy because yeah. you're getting it too.
We rarely talk about these kind of big sort of...
Oh, so was it my fault? I started all this. Yeah.
But no, but it's good because this is part of the whole thing, and it's stuff I think about all the time with my kids about. I mean, this is part of our move out of town a bit too. I really want to teach them some of the stuff that, first of all, that AI can't get.
Mm.
Like all the interpersonal stuff and the all the things that we have that, because we're particularly human, are the only things that are going to... not be threatened by AI at some point in the future. And they're all the things that we're losing the ability to do through social media and all that sort of stuff, all the connectivity. So I don't know, there's so much great things happening and understanding happen simultaneously with this kind of disintegration. It just shows you that everything's got its shadow side. Like we're technologically, people are being pulled out of poverty globally, and we're succeeding on so many levels that simultaneously it seems so ironic.
Mm.
Anyway.
Well, any chance, just before we go, my very last question, any sign of any grandchildren or anything like that?
Oh, well, yeah.
No.
You're in the zone.
I am in the zone. And Chris has been with his lovely partner, Erin, for several years. And I know they're quite keen to have a child. But Erin unfortunately suffers with multiple cirrhosis, and although she seems quite healthy with it, it is something that is quite difficult for them in terms of especially her being able to continue a lot of work, which yep. means that financially it's difficult for them to, you know, yeah. they're living in a shared house arrangement. They really want to get their own place.
Yep.
And Chris quite obstinately, and Erin as well, sort of say, look, until we get our place, we're not going to start a family.
Yeah,
but I know that they... They will be wonderful, amazing parents,
yeah.
and you know, around about that 30-year-old mark now, that sort of like they want to be thinking about it sort of soonish. But they want to improve their situation,
yeah.
their own sort of setup. You know, they've got their dogs that they love, and they want to have they want the Australian dream. They want the house with a backyard or something where they can have the dogs. Because I think at the moment they feel like they're couch surfing too much to be able to start a family.
It's pretty par for the course to kind of go, all right. And well, part of it you think is just, you know, putting off that scary part of your journey.
You know, a few have sort of said, well, maybe you just have to realise that this is the way the world is, and if you keep on putting it off, you don't want to turn around, you know, in some years to come and say, actually, maybe I should have got going and just, you know, got the family underway and then worried about everything later rather than trying. But Chris's nature is very much that he wants to get everything in order.
Yeah,
you know, okay. So when this is right, then I'll do the next bit.
Yeah.
So look, I would say probably within the next couple of years, hopefully I will be a grandfather. Well, I have said.
What about the other one though?
Knowing Dylan, he'll probably already am. Who knows? Who knows? Dylan's also in a relationship with a girl he's been going out with for about a year now, and they seem to be getting along fine. But you know, I mean, She's just finishing her VC. She's a year younger than him, so I mean, I'd be surprised if they have any of those sort of. I mean, they've got travel and all that sort of stuff ahead of them still. First,
you still see him as a kid. When does that change?
Probably a few months ago.
Yeah,
you know, I think when he finished his VCE and he started doing uni. So he's Dylan's a very sporty kid. He's kind of very athletic, and so he's studying sports science and education in Burwood out at. Not Monash, what's the one?
Rusden?
Deakin, at Deakin.
Used to be called Rusden.
Yeah, sure. Mate, brain fade from over there. He's out of Deakin studying that, and now he's driving a car, and so, like, you know, he drives to uni, and he drops around to my place to grab some lunch sometimes, usually when he's run out of money and wants me to buy him a hamburger. And so that's when I started seeing him as an adult, it's the independence. It's when they don't rely on you, and the funny thing is that I actually see probably more of Dylan now that he's sort of out on his own than I did when he was supposedly under my umbrella as a VC, because he was studying so hard. He was just knuckling down. I hardly saw him at all, you know, when he was 18. So I think that's the point where I felt like they're grown up. You know, when they they have their own money and their own bank accounts and they can drive themselves around. And, you know, I think that was probably the defining point, independence, like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Wow. Well, we better wind it up because we're nearly out of tape.
Oh, excellent. Is that why that quarter-inch reel-to-reel is just flapping in the corner there, is it?
Yeah.
The old 8-track.
Thank you, Oaks, so
my
much
pleasure
for coming. Yeah,
thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
That got very intense there for a few minutes.
Yes. So we have fixed the world now. Oh, everything's God. Right.
I think everything right. Should be right. Once this is released, things should start healing in the world.
Yes, no doubt.
I'd say once the listenership gets
We just got to teach our kids to have good ethics and good, you know, that's all we can do now, gents. We can try to give them some kind of hope for the future.
Well, that sounds a bit like it's a last resort, like it's all overdone and dusted and we've lost.
Yeah.
Talk like that. But
well, we've passed on our genetics. That's all we've – that's
it. Let's start it again, Daniel. That was the wind-up. He's off again. He's off again. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for
good
watching.
Night, folks.
That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.